Blog Talk Radio.
Evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stuart Thompson. Welcome to Personal Transformation, a show I like to have called basically for survivors for childhood sexual abuse. I'm here offering you peer support only. I'm not a doctor or a physician of anything of any sort. A lot of my views are my own and what I've learned through the Gatehouse. I'm broadcasting live here from the Gatehouse. It's 7 o'clock on a Thursday night, rainy night outside, even some thunder and lightning, not bad for an October. Dark, leaves are all changed, starting to fall, beautiful colors. It's a great night. I'm happy to be here. First off, my program, I noted I'm going to be talking about addictions. I am going to be talking about addictions, and I also noted that I was trying to get an interview with John Swales. I'm going to get into more about John in a little bit. Unfortunately, he could not. I couldn't do the interview with him tonight. I'll tell you more about that a little later on. But first, I want to talk about some announcements that I have here at the Gatehouse. And first off, before we go any further than that, the Gatehouse is located obviously in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We're located at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard West, or Old Etobicoke. It can be reached at area code 416-255-5900. And you can speak with either Paula or Maria or anybody in the house and be happy to help you. And on the web, we are at www.thegatehouse.org. And you can reach that way as well. And myself personally, you can reach me at personaltransformation@thegatehouse.org. If you'd like to send an email to me, any feedback would appreciate it, bad or good, I don't care, just send it to me, I'm all ears, and we're pretty much on our way here, but like I say, it's a wet, rainy night outside, and I'm going to get back to, I was talking about John. Well, John couldn't be here tonight, John Swales, I should say to you, is located in London, Ontario, Canada. Those who don't know where that is, London, Ontario, Canada, is located to the, would be from the west of Toronto, 401, and that's how you get to London, Ontario. Now, tonight, what John is going to be doing, he started he's having a conversation tonight, and he's calling it Journey to Discuss Destination for Men. Now, I know it says for men, but it also does include women. Now, it's going to be at the Goodwills Industry 255 Horton Street Conference Center, 3-4 in London. And actually, it started already. It started about an hour ago. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. And it's pretty much a conversation is about, well, what I'm talking about. There's no support out there. And John is taking it upon himself with some other good people to do something about this out there, to offer support. And I know he's going to be, he's got a lot of good things to offer, and it'll be interesting to talk with him. In fact, I was talking to him earlier this evening, and he agreed to talk with me tomorrow. So I'm going to basically, when I talk to him tomorrow, being Friday the 17th of October, 2014, he agreed to talk with me tomorrow, so I'm going to do that tomorrow. I'm going to have a live. I'm going to record it, so I'll broadcast it next week here on Blog Talk Radio, Personal Transformation, and I can't wait to talk to him in regards to what he's doing here tonight. So basically, what the conversation will be about? Well, what do men want? Men live their whole lives with meaningful interaction with others and have few opportunities to discover what's really important. What can they disconnect with men to do to change the situation? So basically, we're talking about sexual abuse, and the physical destination for men does not exist yet, although it's still in a transformation point. This is the first project that they want, a physical place in London where men can come together. And I should include women as well, because that's what he's going to do. It's going to be men and women. So tonight, they're having a social get-together, a committee, or a conference, and they're going to be talking about that. It's a community thing, and it includes women or as partners as well, and it's very important. I commend John for doing this. Now, I'm going to read you a little bit more about John that I got from one of the local newspapers in London, Ontario. And actually, it's from the London Free Press. And give you a little bit more about who I'm talking about. So basically, John is a fierce, outspoken, or John, as I'm talking about, has fought this trauma of sexual abuse, addiction, prostitution, law, lawyers, Catholic Church, social service agencies, and the government of Ontario to be where he's at. Now he just wants to talk. Swales is 54, a little bit more reseasoned by age, as the article says, wants to talk to other men in the center of creating by men to help each other, or peer support, as we like to call it. I call it a designation for men, simply because it would be, as Swales said, we are still socially conditioned to be upon our own. And if you don't get what he's talking about, survivors, we basically, that's what we do. We basically isolate ourselves, and as he makes reference to, that's actually a very neat way of putting it. We don't like to be told what to do, that's for sure. We don't like to admit when we're weak. All our attributes that hamstring us cause a lot of damage. Swales is putting out a call for men and agencies interested in building a center for men that they can find and offer support to each other. And if desired, get access to. Our initial step is to draw men together to discuss the appetite for a need for such place and what men want. And I should include women as well. Swales has a moral support from several agencies and social service social leaders in London, such as the head of the regional HIV/AIDS connection, Brian Lester. There's many needs for men that are unaddressed, he said. I think this is the time for our community to come together and have a discussion to address these services. John's vision of a destination for men, for a variety of reasons. There's a merit exploring that Swales has worked with this idea for months, putting feelers out for men in communities and agencies. He admits it's a different approach for him. Fighting back had become a second nature to Swales. Swales and his brothers were sexually abused by a Roman Catholic priest, Barry Glendening, in the 1970s. The abuse that started when Swales was 10 sent him into a downward spiral of alcohol, drug abuse, prostitution, to pay for the drugs, and trouble with the law and relationships. He battled back as he did with his brothers, and three of them went public in 2000 with their struggles. The Swales family successfully sued the Roman Catholic diocese and Glendening in 2004. In the fall of 2010, Swales found himself with another battle in his own hands. Then the Attorney General of London, West MPP Chris Bentley, announced a $2.2 million program to help male survivors of sexual abuse across Ontario. Critics charged the government and didn't consult male survivors in creating this program, ignoring the recommendations of the Cornwall Public Inquirer into abuse. If you don't remember about that, the Cornwall Public Inquiry, this is obviously Cornwall, Ontario, Canada. This is the eastern part of Canada. And some of the homes that they had there that the priests had for boys and girls, well, they went through the same thing. And if you were to Google it, and you'll see it's very similar to what I'm talking about that John went through. And we'll explain it all better than I'm trying to explain it right now. Excuse me. Pitted small agencies against each other for a handful of dollars and set up a plan, wrestling in money going into agencies, associations, with the same Catholic Church that turned a blind eye for abuse decades. That's basically falling back to what I'm talking about. Swales said he hopes and the agencies work together, but we'll push on separately, and we'll push separately if needed. Lester insisted that Swales and his ideas have to be included if anyone in London is to consider creating a men's center. And like I say, this article comes from the London Free Press. And if you want to email in regards to what I've just talked about, And you can be reached at randy.richmond@sunmedia.ca. So that is really, I really commend him for doing that. That's really something big out there. I know it's needed out there, and it will definitely go a long way in the community out there, as there is no help out there for survivors of sexual abuse, whether it be men or women. And as I've talked about lots of times, in regards to some kind of support, well, there's not a whole lot out there. There is stuff out there, but it's few and far between. Some of the bigger centers in like Toronto, for example, Ottawa. I'm only giving you stuff off the top of my head that I can think of, but for example, like Toronto, obviously we got the Gatehouse, Belleville. I did an interview with Lee, Men of Hope. And same thing in Ottawa, they've got a place there. I know they have help in Calgary. Now, what's really, really bad about this whole thing is, well, there's help out there, and it is sparse, but it is also, what I'm thinking about, what I always think about, is the outlying communities outside the big centers, like Northern Ontario. It doesn't have to be Northern Ontario. It could be Northern Saskatchewan. It could be Northern Quebec, even, you know, Northern Nova Scotia, places like that, across Canada, that have got absolutely no support at all, in any way or fashion. And if they do want support, well, they have to go online and try to find it, like I've done and found out. Like, I've talked about Twitter quite on more than one occasion, where I found support groups on there. They're quite willing to give you support. I mean, granted, it's something. It's better than nothing, and in most cases now, that's all there is nothing. But something is better than nothing. So my point being is that there is help. Sure, it's spread out really thin. And the more we put the word out, well, maybe it'll change. Maybe governments will finally cough up some more funds to have funding to get people, or to get these agencies, or all these or the municipalities, even, for example, to fund there are people in social services to give some kind of peer support for this kind of problem. I mean, there's not many people can offer support in this issue. Sure, you can go to a psychiatrist or to a psychologist or to a therapist. But I mean, don't get me wrong, that's still good too. But that only goes so far. There's nothing better than getting, well, in my personal opinion, there's nothing better than getting support from someone who's been there and gone through it, such as myself and many others that I know have gone through the same process. Thank heavens for the likes of the Gatehouse giving me that opportunity, and this opportunity here tonight where I'm talking about it. You know, I said from the beginning of the program, I'm talking about awareness. This is what it's all about, and that's what I'm preaching about. I don't even like you saying that word preach, but this is what I'm talking about. This is what I want the public to know. People need to be aware. You know, that this is a big problem, not just here in Canada, in the U.S., U.K. It's a global issue, and people need to be aware about it. People don't have to be afraid to talk about it. You know, that's why I'm here, to show you that I'm not afraid to talk about it. I'm just plain fed up, and I want something done. So that's why I'm here talking about it and supporting the issue. Sad as it sounds, but that is the fact. So I've kind of got that out of the way, and I really look forward to talking to John tomorrow, and I know I'll have a great interview with him. John's got lots of great insight. He's been around for quite a while, and he's got lots to offer. And furthermore, I should throw this in as well. If you want to reach John, you can reach him at S-Wales, or S-W-A-L-E-S, at tcc.on.ca. Again, that's S-Wales, or S-W-A-L-E-S, at tcc.on, or Ontario, or on.ca. If you have any questions, or if you'd like to talk to him, I'm sure he'd get back to you. So now, like I was talking about, obviously I'm not interviewing John, but we are going to talk about addictions. And addictions, well, it's funny, because we were talking about this last night. I was here at the house last night, and we had a group, and this is in the phase one, or the beginning of your cycle, as we call it here. And this is what we're talking about. We're talking about addiction. So I'm very, very, very fortunate. I'm with a group of men that are very, very forthcoming. They like to talk. And I'm also very lucky, too. I have two other great facilitators with me as well. So I'm very, very fortunate to have a group like this. So for you who don't understand what addictions are, and I'm sure a lot of you do, what is addiction? Well, addiction is often referred to as a disease. Is it, though? That's a really good question. Is it a disease? Addiction is a disease of emotions. Addictive behavior is never the substance, activity, or attitude with which the person is acting out addictively. It is always about distortion of the person's real feelings and the inability to connect with self or others. Addiction is driven by shame and fear. Shame and fear are extremely uncomfortable feelings. Shame says things like, I'm not good enough. I'm no good. No one loves me. I don't matter. I'm bad and I'm worthy. I get everything wrong. You're not as good as they are. Hear that thunder. Isn't that lovely? Then fear says, those statements are true. But always, so often, believe or shame, we feel sad, bad, unloved, unwanted, disconnected from others. Fearful, trapped, needing to hide, wanting to isolate, etc. So, do any of those things kind of resonate with anybody? Well, I know they sure do with me. Because you know what, when I'm talking about addiction could be many, many, many different things that you could be addicted to. Or, as I sometimes refer to, like addiction could be like like being OCD. Like, I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong in this, but to me, that's how I make reference to sometimes, because when I'm compulsive about things, to me, that's like being addicted, especially if I'm compulsive to it all the time. I'm only giving you an example, but that's pretty much what I'm getting at. Addictive behavior is an ability to alter reality in such a way we don't have to feel anything that we deem as uncomfortable. Addiction is a capacity to manipulate our reality so we numb ourselves to any emotion, event, relationship, trauma, and or experience that we believe will create any discomfort emotionally, mentally, physically, socially, financially, and so forth. Addiction is destructive. It destroys connection, all connections. Addiction is not a respecter of persons. It certainly isn't. It will penetrate anyone who is not willing or who does not know how to feel and experience reality as it presents itself to them. We're not willing to experience reality as it authentically happens, then addictive thinking will begin to control our reality with faulty core beliefs. Our beliefs are based on shame as we unconsciously engage in this distortion of emotions and reality. Clinical patterns begin to develop. Denial forms as a central part of these patterns. Yeah, denial. You know, I did a stint last year where I went to, I went to AA and I went to NA. And, well, I kind of thought I was having the reason why I went is I thought I might have been having a substance problem. Well, what the real reason why I really went was because I was struggling with self-destruction. Well, that could be an addiction as well. And I thought I should throw that in there as well. It doesn't have to be just necessarily about drugs and alcohol or sex. Addiction comes in many different forms. And I thought very important that I should mention this just so you'll understand that, like I say, addiction comes in many different forms. Like as I just described, it doesn't have to be just drugs or alcohol or a sex addict. This is what we hear through the media all the time, constantly thrown in our faces. Addiction can come in many different forms, you know. And the last thing I said when I was talking about this, I also talked about denial, you know. And that was one of the things I was probably doing the most. I was denying that I was doing this to myself. So that's why I went to go seek to see if I can find another way of not doing that. Granted, I knew a whole lot of what was going on with myself. I've talked about myself quite a bit, and really I don't particularly enjoy doing that, but if it means getting my point across so you out there, the listener, can understand what I'm talking about, me being an example, then maybe you can understand or correlate where I'm coming from. Because it's not that simple, and it's not simple, and it's actually very complex, because when you think about it, it's all involved with this. There's so many different types of addictions you could use, that a person could have regarding obviously I'm here when we're talking about sexual abuse, but all the examples are pertaining to fall back to sexual abuse. Well, still people still go out and they have these behavior habits or as addictions as what we're discussing, and many, many different forms. Now I talked about self-destruction. Well, to me, that was an addiction. I've done that for so long. I really didn't know any better, and I've been working on trying to change that. But it's not that easy. It's like a lot of things. You just, after you've done something for so long, well, it's hard to change. I'm a firm believer that I've always been told that, well, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So I disagree with that. You can teach an old dog new tricks. I've seen it time and time again, and that's why I refuse to give up. And that's why I'm talking like the way I'm talking right now, just so you'll understand that you can change. I've changed. So you can change as well. So there's no real excuse. You just have to put the effort into it. And be quite clear, I put a lot of effort into it. I'm putting a lot more effort into it. And it's gonna take some time, but I'm going to get past this. And I refuse not to give up on this. And I'm going to talk about it and show you that things can change over a period of time. I'll hear that thunder. Isn't that wild? That's the kind of night I'm having here tonight. Thunder lightning out. Hopefully it's not the last one. But nevertheless, we're talking about addiction. And I've kind of we got dial in here now. And I'm hoping you're kind of getting an idea of what we're talking about. Well, here's an exercise you can do with yourself. You know, you can write it down or just put in your thoughts. What are your thoughts about the definition of addiction? Shame, fear, and denial. And see how that manifests in your life or the life life of your loved ones. So think about that. Again, I'll ask you again. Write or think about your thoughts about the definition of addiction, shame, fear, and denial. And see how they manifest in your life or in the life of your loved ones. And see where that goes. Now, I'm going to talk about some myths regarding addiction. I'm just finding it here. Okay, now, granted, okay, the examples I'm going to give you refer to as a statement I just made. Addiction doesn't have to be about drugs or alcohol. It could be many different things. So just bear with me. Okay, well, here's a myth. You have a drink to, you have to drink every day to be an alcoholic. Is that true or false? You have to be drunk every day to be an alcoholic. Is it true or false? Or myth or non-myth? Someone who drinks only wine or beer cannot be an alcoholic. What do you think? All alcoholics are criminals. What do you think? All alcoholics are unpleasant to be around. Another myth. If you drink for a long time, you'll always become an alcoholic. Well, like I say, these are myths. Is there any other myths you know about? How about some facts now? Once you are an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. Well, that is true. Alcoholism is a progressive disease with no cure. You know that. Alcoholics are not a specific age, sex, race, or religion, or gender. Well, actually, I said that in the sex. You know what I'm trying to say. Many practicing alcoholics function normally in their day-to-day lives in their daily stages. Many alcoholics hide the amount that they drink from other people, leading others to believe that they are either or do not drink at all or only drinking with others. Treatment does not guarantee long-term sobriety, but the longer you stay sober, the better chances you are continuing to stay sober. One thing, I must make a comment on that. One thing, when I was going to NA and I went to NA, man, I met a lot of good people that have stayed off the booze and the drugs. And like I'm talking about for long periods of time. Like I'm talking like I met people that were off of it for like 15 years, 10 years, even 5 years. That's a long time. I remember one gentleman in particular I met in Newmarket, and he got and he was there for his alcohol abuse, and he received a 30-year medallion, and that's pretty incredible. 30 years without a drop. Treatment does not guarantee long-term sobriety, but the longer you stay sober, the better chances are of continuing to stay sober. That is so true, as I was just saying. That's why I wanted to say that. Being an alcoholic and having a drinking problem are not the same thing. Alcoholics have a physical dependence. People with alcoholic problems do not. The average lifespan of participating alcoholics is 52 years. So basically, as I've been saying all the way from the beginning, there are a lot of addictions, and I only mentioned a few of the obvious, which we see in our faces every day, which are drugs and alcohol. There's sex, for example. There's gambling, for example. I'm only touching the tip of the iceberg. I've only mentioned the ones that people hear about on the media all the time. There's compulsive buyers. You know, we're talking. It's funny because we were watching Gabe Mate on TED Talks on YouTube last night, and part of our addictions, and it does not, and he was making reference to himself going out and buying. Buying CDs or music. He was hooked on music. So what he would do is he would go out every day, for example. He'd go out every day, and he was into music, but he'd go out every day, and he'd buy. And times he's gone where he's been in looking after a patient because he's also a physician as well. And he said he would step out and he'd go buy music while he was in the middle of taking care of a patient. And that's pretty extreme or pretty compulsive regards to an addiction. But anyway, that's what he would do. And he would go and literally he'd buy thousands of dollars worth of CDs. That was his addiction. And as an example of another type of an addiction, I can even kind of relate to that to myself. Never mind the alcohol and the drugs that I've taken in the past, but I know for the longest time I would do. That's how I could really relate to that. I would go out and do the same thing. And that's probably why I got such a huge music collection today. And granted, I wasn't buying classical music like he was, but old-time rock and roll, blues, psychedelic, that was the kind of stuff I went into. So I've got a crazy, crazy music collection. I would do anything. I would go to secondhand stores. I'd buy them new. But I just had to go. I'd probably do it. I remember for probably 3-4 years straight, I would probably go at least once, twice, sometimes three times a week, and that's exactly what I did. I just bought music, and that was my addiction. I guess you can call that. And I still kind of have addiction towards that, although I've sidestepped it and I've done other things. Actually, this is my addiction now. My addiction now is the Gatehouse, and that's a good thing. It's better than what I've had before. So it left me. Much better than what I had before. So I hope you're kind of getting an idea of what I'm talking about in regards to addiction and how many different areas it can affect you many different areas that you can have an addiction is what I'm trying to say. The trouble with addiction is it comes with a whole lot of bad attributes to go along with it. And some true and some not true. It basically gives you faulty core beliefs. Like, for example, like Well, I've talked about it from the beginning, like I said, well, where I'm bad or I'm unworthy, I'm not good enough, I don't deserve it, my body's the wrong shape, my hair is too blonde, I'm dumb, that's just all part of the guilt, I guess, you carry where you say these things to yourself, or as I would say, self-worth. I've made reference to lots of times in the past. So basically, distorted reality. Consistently distorting, changing reality to avoid my shame based on beliefs. It's okay for me to be irresponsible. That's rationalizing. Well, rationalizing to yourself. They meant to hurt me. Well, that's minimizing it. They dare them. I don't deserve acting like a victim. I know that rule applies to, well, whoever. That's just you're omitting. Most people, I'm different. Well, that's you're just complying. All those examples are basically distorted reality or distorted belief. Faulty core beliefs. I'm bad. I'm unlovable. I'm not worth it. Distorted reality, rationalization, minimizing, acting like a victim, you view all those experiences through shame, unmanageability, out of control, perfectionism, obsessive compulsive, it's just a shame cycle, addictive cycle, acting out on drugs, sex, codependency. All those things, of course, sort of fall into that belief why you do those sort of things. And the trouble with all that stuff, when you do that, you have consequences. Your consequences of your emotional dishonesty to yourself. Consequences of your emotional dishonesty. Look at this. Listen to these things and tell me if you can relate to any of these things. For example, if you're feeling, if you have that shame feeling, does your stomach ache with anger? Do you have a guilty feeling? First of all, let me be a little more clear about this. I talk about emotional dishonesty. So I'm just giving you some examples now. I'm going to give you some physical symptoms that maybe you can relate to. So basically, when I was talking about when you're feeling shame, do you get like a stomachache? Do you feel anger? Okay, like when you, as a physical symptom. And when you're feeling guilty, do you have sleep disorders? Or do you get withdrawn? Or do you isolate? So when you become guarded, your muscles tense? You get disconnected, detached? When you start becoming defensive, you get headaches, you become selfish. Again, these last parts I'm talking about are physiological symptoms. Continued lying, anxiety, entitled, isolation, depression, controlling, secretive, and demanding. Difficulty, disconcerting truth and lies. Perfectionism. Can you add some more to this list I've talked about? I gave you a pretty good list. There's not a whole lot more to cover. But I'm sure if you can find something, you can add something to that as well. Well, I hope you get an idea of what we're talking about here now. And more clear. Addictions it was a great topic last night, and I'm still kind of happy to be talking about it now. So here I have some questions for you. Name three things, okay? Whether it be activities, things, people, attitudes, substances, or emotions to which you feel you are addicted. Think about that, okay? Here's another one. Name three areas. Okay? Relationships, job or career, physically, financial, financially, that is, legally, sexually, etc., where you are experiencing life-damaging consequences as a result of being addicted. So can you name three there, as I've asked you to do for the first question? So basically, while you're doing this, write down any of the thoughts about these choices or consequences that you've chosen. When you identify specific negative consequences in your life, well, it becomes easier to recognize what you are addicted to. So I'm just giving you a little helping hand here if in fact you need that. So let's talk about addictive cycles. So name a drug of choice or an addiction and walk yourself through it. So what's your preoccupation to bring you to that point where you're going to do that choice of addiction? Let me give you some examples here before going further. How I would preoccupy myself prior to, I'd say, the end of the day. Let's say this was a Friday, for example. Now, okay, I go to work. And the first thing I think about is where I'm going to score when I get off work. In fact, is if I'm really smart, I'm going to call ahead to my friend and say, okay, can you set me up for after work? Or, you know, that's what I would do. I would pre-plan it I would preoccupy myself with those thoughts during the day. Even though it was at work, I would still have those thoughts in my day. Well, how is I gonna satisfy my addiction at the end of the day? And that was foremost my thought. How to solve that problem. So think about that. So how do you preoccupy yourself? And say, as your example, if you're at work, as I just stated with myself, how do you preoccupy yourself throughout the day? Write it down. See what happens. See what you get out of it. Especially those the list of questions that I had, rather the two questions I asked you about, and naming the areas, both for your how you feel you're addicted, and what are the consequences of being addicted when you do those things. So basically, now we've discussed preoccupation. I talk about planning out your day for how you're gonna tackle your addiction. Now, what are your rituals? What behaviors and or compulsions do you engage in to get closer to your drug of choice or addiction? That's a really good question. Write that down too. You're at it. And acting out. Name the substance or activity that you use to act out with. Your drug of choice or your addiction of choice. So what do you do? What would you write down? Okay, shame and pain. What do I feel sad, mad, shame, etc. about? It leads me back into preoccupations as I was discussing. So what happens that makes you sad or bad or feel shame or, you know, where's your guilt kick in? What makes you fall back to those addictions? See, the great thing about what we're talking about with addictions and the great thing about it here is when we talk about it at the Gatehouse, especially in the Phase 1 program. Okay, well, first off, you're here because you're here at the Gatehouse because you've been abused as a child. Now we're teaching you how to deal with that. But unfortunately, along the way, most of us survivors or victims, along the way, have picked up all these habits, and a good majority of them are not so good. So now you can kind of comprehend what I'm getting at here, that by writing down the stuff I'm asking you to do, it gives you a better idea of where you're coming from. But kind of like what I've talked about in the other components I've talked about along the way. I've talked about shame, guilt, all those things. That all stems from those things we've talked about. And I've mentioned countless times now And oh, by the way, I didn't mention that. This is my 20th show. Woohoo! But anyway, nevertheless, I hope this resonates with you, or it makes you think about it. I, in fact, hell, if you're right, if writing some of this down to help yourself, that's kind of the idea. This is what self-help is all about: is recognizing these issues, and then being able to tackle them on a more personal level. So, I hope you're getting the idea about that. We're talking about guilt and shame. I've talked about guilt lots of times, and it has a real, real, well, it has a way of getting a hold of you. Last week we talked about anger. So, think about the next time you get angry, and you're going to go and do that so-called addiction of choice. I'm just hoping that this time, that when you do it, that what I've told you or trying to tell you is that you might better recognize it and better catch yourself, and maybe you'll change something to stop that addiction. Easier said than done, but I guess the biggest part is recognizing and admitting that you have an addiction of some sort. I guess is the biggest thing. And then being able to have some kind of grasp of what's going on. I guess that's pretty much the hardest part. Just being able to be honest with yourself. Say, okay, well, this is what's going on with me. And I need to do this for myself. And what I've noticed with a lot of people with addictions, especially survivors, it's a really hard thing to do, and it's not an easy thing to overcome. And I guess what it falls right down to, which I can honestly say for myself, I've talked about fear countless times, and how fear and anger and how they all come together. But fear is a nasty thing. You know, it's funny how it can take a hold of you and not basically allow you to do things in a so-called responsible manner. And it's really, really awful what it'll do to an individual. Now, basically, what you want to try to do, it really helps you in clarifying your feelings and emotions by looking deep at inside yourself and recognizing that you have that anger and shame. So basically, you've been struggling all this time, and you haven't been able to figure out why. Well, a lot of us. Survivors. That's what we've done is in order to cope, and that's how we cope is we find some kind of. Well, I've talked about self-destruction, but that's just another form of self-destruction. Whatever your addiction may be, and I know other people are going to have different views on what I'm talking about, and a lot of what I'm saying is factual. It's not just coming out of my head, and I'm not just saying. A lot of what I've said is actually true. There's no doubt about that. And if you've been through this process already, you know what I'm talking about. So basically, you basically need to regroup, and think about what's going on. Regrouping is a transforming stage where people start learning and trust appropriately. And most importantly, they learn to trust themselves. And this is a big thing about trusting yourself. Well, if you can trust yourself, then you can trust others. You know, which I've talked about with myself, where I've had struggles trusting myself. You got to develop these skills so you can assist in getting your needs met in a healthy fashion versus taking it out on an addiction. You're taking responsibility for your lives and for your life, rather, and giving yourself empowerment. with enhanced feelings of self-worth for a change. You know, not having any self-worth, I mean, I've talked to countless times, and it takes a lot of work. People work very hard to get to this point and are starting to be like a new person. And I've seen this in the house. This is great. They are learning to find their own voice, the voice that is able to speak their truth, not hidden lies. In the previous stages, you would recognize or you would characterize themselves as existing and not living. Well, that's what happens when you have an addiction, like drugs and alcohol. You basically isolate yourself. I know I did whenever I got into it to any degree. You know, you need to redefine your friendships, once you've discovered the stuff, you'll be able to redefine your friendships, and you better improve your intimacy both in relationship and love. You better improve your friendships. You know, you better improve. You know, you won't be I hate using this term lonely, but loneliness. You know, that insets with us quite often, and I can speak for myself. That's one thing for sure. So you can basically convert your loneliness into being comfortable around other people, and wanting to be be part of something instead of being basically stuck at home, sucking back in that bottle or watching that porn movie or doing that drug of choice, because there's always a way out. So when you understand what's going on with yourself or those experiences you've gone through, then that's your stepping stone to getting started. I suppose I could talk about addictions a lot more, but I can only beat the horse for so long. So I don't know what else I can say much more about it other than I'd be repeating myself, and I might have already done that a couple times, and I apologize for that. But nevertheless, I kind of gave you a brief outline of how we deal with it here at the Gatehouse in regards to that. And don't forget, there's always AA out there. There's NA out there. They have support out there for gambling, Gambling Anonymous, Sex Anonymous. There's all kinds of support out there, actually more so than I think for even survivors of sexual abuse, but that's not my point. That's not what I'm getting at. I'm talking about that there is support out there if you have a gambling problem, a drug problem, for many different things where you're addicted and you can get help. But like I've said, many survivors of sexual abuse, I won't say everybody, but definitely a good portion that I've met have had some sort of addiction at one point in life, and many that I've met have gone through and done the thing, their time, and they don't do that stuff anymore now. Now they've got a better hold of their life. So I would recommend that if this is a real problem for you, obviously you can't come to the Gatehouse, and we talk about addiction, but we're not, and we'll give you support, but you got to remember, we're probably here for survivors of sexual abuse, but we have to cover addictions as part of our criteria in regards to getting through this program, so you understand what's going on, so you understand that, so you can basically understand why you resorted to those addictions. So like I said, I've pretty much talked enough about that. I don't know how much more I can say other than to tell you that to go to NA or AA or any of those places and seek help, and you'll feel a lot better that you have. I know I have. I went and I went to AA and NA, just like I said, for my self-destruction, and I got a lot of good out of it, an awful lot of good out of it. And gradually, I'm still struggling on some things, but that's all right. And I'm accepting that. I've accepted that, and I'm diligently working, and I've sought help and getting help in regards so I don't have to fall back in that. So, like I said, right from the beginning, my addiction would have been self-destruction, and that's a really good way of summing it up for myself. But anyway, like I say, enough of that. I can't beat that over the head any more than I have. There's one more little announcement I'm going to make, and I'm going to cover what I've talked about already again before, but I have another couple few more announcements I want to make before. This will not be a full night for me tonight, but I do have a few other things I would like to talk about. The Gatehouse on Saturday, October 25th, which I believe is next weekend, we'll be having a fundraising charity event, and it's for Boeing. And it will be at 2561 Stanfield Road, Mississauga. And it will be from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. And it's $20 per person. And I believe a good portion or most of the money will be coming back here to the Gatehouse as far as fundraising is concerned. Another fundraising event that the Gatehouse will be doing will be at Mr. Mike Maple Leaf Lounge, which is on the Lake Shore and not far from here. Actually, it's at 2749 Lakeshore Boulevard West between 2nd and 3rd Street. And there is a band that's going to be playing there. They're called Oakland Stroke. If you YouTube them, you'll find them. And they're actually just a cover band, but they sound really, really good. So basically, Mr. Mike is putting this on. He's covered it, but this is the catch. There'll be a $35 charge to get in, but all the money raised will be coming back to the gate. And you can reach Mr. Mike at area code 647-782-4880. And basically, well, obviously, sponsors for this charity event are going to be, it's going to be the Maple Leaf House, Grill and Lounge. And that's where the band's going to be performing. And actually, incidentally, that's a great place to go if you'd like to catch bands, other aside from what I've been mentioning. And all the proceeds are coming back to the Gatehouse. So basically, a little bit more about the band. It's a 10-piece soul funk band with a 5-piece horn section made up of some of the best musicians in Toronto. And recent appearances in the Toronto Jazz Festival, Beaches Jazz Festival, Newmarket Jazz Festival, Southside Shuffle in Mississauga. So these guys have been around for a while, and I know I'm trying to think if I've ever seen them before, but I'm going to have to check them out on YouTube to be absolutely sure. But I've seen a few renditions of similar bands like this. So it sounds pretty exciting. So I'm definitely going to check it out. I definitely recommend that you, if you can get out to come and check this out, and if you can afford it, please come out and support the Gatehouse. Now, I'm going to go totally to the other side here now. And I hope you don't find this too disturbing, but nevertheless, this needs to be discussed. I've always talked about this countless times. And, well, okay, granted, okay, right off the top, the Gatehouse is a house for survivors of sexual abuse, and we're here to help you through your trials and tribulations of being a survivor, or rather from a victim to becoming a survivor. Now, what I like to do, which I got passed down to me, and if I'm not mistaken, this was passed down through Lynn McNell, who I've interviewed in the past. And this is an article through the New York Times. And obviously, what I'm talking about, pedophilia. Now, most survivors, well, pedophile, well, most of us would, you know, most of our, you know, people that have done to this, or pedophiles, have done these things to us. Most of us have got a, well, without being rude, and I'm trying to keep it clean here, without being too, without sounding like I'm being, I'm just being just downright nasty, that most of us survivors would rather just see our pedophiles, well, I can say it this way, would rather have them euthanized. But that's not what I'm getting at. But anyway, there was a study that was done, and this was posted in the New York Times, and I thought I would read this and share this with you. And I'm sure you'll find this somewhat controversial, and you may not agree, and you may agree, you may disagree, but that's a great thing about media and about freedom of choice. You can decide what you want. Yeah, and I would really appreciate an email what you think about when I read this to you, what you think about this, and I would love your opinion regarding this matter. because there's a huge problem. I've talked about this kind of briefly off and on. What do we do with a pedophile after they've been put through the system? How do you treat a pedophile? How do you deal with it? You know, never mind the victim or the survivor after the fact. That's another big, huge story in itself. But what do you do with these people when they go through the courts, and then you got to release them? And there's a whole bunch of different things we could talk about in regards to that. But I'm only going to specifically talk about this article that I've received, and I thought it was pretty interesting when I read it. I can't say I agree or disagree on some of these things. Well, I do. I agree on some things, and I disagree on some things, which I won't go out of my way and point them out. But there's some things I agree with in this article, and some things I don't. So basically, pedophilia is a disorder. They make reference to being a disorder, not a crime. This is by Camden NJ. This is the person that did the study on it. And first off, it comes from the New York Times, and it's written by Margot Kaplan. She's the lady who wrote this article. But like I said, the article is by Camden NJ. I guess if you Google that, you can find this as well. So this is what the article says. Think back to your first childhood crush. Maybe it was a classmate or a friend next door, most likely through school and into childhood, adulthood. Your affections continue to focus on others in your approximate age group. But imagine if they did not. By some estimates, 1% of the male population continues along after puberty to find themselves attracted to, it's funny how this is written, before pre-puberty is what I'm trying to say, or children. These people are living with a pedophile. A sexual attraction to this individual often constitutes a mental illness. Unfortunately, our laws are failing them and consequently are ignoring the opportunities to prevent child abuse. Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the Mental Disorders defines that pedophilia is an intense and reoccurring sexual interest in the pre-puberty stage of children, and a disorder if it is cause for a person marked distress or in personal difficulty, or if the person acts on his interests, yet our laws ignore pedophilia until after the commission of a sexual offense. So you see how it's defined here. It's kind of weird the way I said it, but how they define pedophile versus a sexual offense, or when you get charged and been through the system. So they word it differently, so basically before and after. Part of this failure stems from the misconception that pedophilia is the same as child molestation. One can live with pedophilia, I should say, and not act on it. Sites like Vitreous Pedophiles provide support for pedophiles who do not molest children and believe that sex with children is wrong. I still don't understand that. Why? I don't get that. I haven't really wrapped my head around that, and I really don't really intend to try to figure that out, because it's just all wrong in all ways. Why would you want to view children doing whatever? I just can't imagine that, and will not imagine that. It's just beyond my comprehension. It is not that of the individuals are inactive or non-participating pedophilias, but rather that the pedophile is in a status and not an act. In fact, research shows about half of all children molesters are not sexually attracted to their victims. We've talked about this before. They're not. The second misconception is that a pedophilia is a choice. recent research, while often limited to sex offenders because of the stigma of pedophilia, suggests that disorder may have neurological origins. A pedophilia could not result from a failure in the brain to identify which environmentally stimulate should provoke a sexual response. MRIs of some offenders with pedophilia show fewer neural pathways known to as white matter in their brains. This is really weird here now. This is what I'm talking about, where some things I agree and disagree with. Men with pedophilia are 3 times more likely to be left-handed or ambidextrous. A finding that strongly suggests that the neurological cause, some findings are also suggest that disturbances of the neural developments into the ultra or early childhood increases the risk of pedophilia. Studies have also shown that men with pedophilia have, on average, lower scores on tests of visual, spatial ability, and verbal memory, which is kind of odd. Again, like I said, I haven't put too much thought into that, but that's what it says here. This is just a study. And again, like I say, I'm quoting from the New York Times. Virtuous Pedophiles website is a full testimonials of people who vow never to touch a child and yet live in terror. They must hide their disorder from everyone that they know, or risk losing educational job opportunities and face prospect of harassment, even violence. Many feel isolated. Some contemplate suicide. Psychologist Jesse Bering, author of Perv, Sexual Deviant, and All of Us. Again, Google that and you can find out that's a book about called The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. All of Us and You writes that with people with pedophilia aren't living their lives in the closet. They're internally hankered down in a panic group. While treatment cannot eliminate a pedophile's sexual interest, a combination of cognitive behavior therapy, medication can help him to manage his urges and avoid committing crimes. The reasons we don't know enough about effective treatment is because the research has usually been limited to those who have committed the crimes. Our current law, and may I also state this is in the U.S., not Canada, our current law is inconsistent our rotation. For example, federal law and 20 states allow courts to issue a civil order committing a sex offender, particularly one with a diagnosis of pedophilia, to a mental health facility immediately after completion of his sentence. Under standards that are more lax than for ordinary civil, commitment, for people with mental illness, and yet when it comes to public policies that might help with people with pedophilia to come to forward to seek treatment for their for what they've offended. The law omits pedophilia from protection. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 prohibit discrimination against otherwise qualified individuals with mental disabilities in areas such as employment, education, and medical care. Congress, however, explicitly excluded pedophilia from the from protection under these two critical laws. So you notice how even in the U.S. law that I just described, they kept that out of there. I wonder why they did that. Well, actually, I'll read on and maybe it'll tell us. It's time to revisit the categorically exclusion without legal protection. A pedophilia cannot risk seeking treatment or disclosure from his status from anyone for support. He could lose his job and his future, his job prospects. If he is seen at a group therapy session, asks for his reasonable accommodation to take medication or to see a psychiatrist, or requests a limit in his interaction with children, isolating individuals from appropriate employment and treatment only increases the risk of committing a crime again. There is no question that the extension of the civil rights protections with the people with pedophilia must be weighed against the health and safety needs of others, especially kids. It stands to reason that Pelletier should not be hired as a grade school teacher, but both the ADA and Rehabilitation and the Rehabilitation Act contain exemptions for people who are not otherwise qualified for this job or who pose a direct threat to the health and safety of others. They can't be eliminated by a reasonable accommodation. This is why employers don't have to hire blind bus drivers or mentally unstable security guards. The direct threat analyst rejects the idea that employers can rely on generalizations. They must assess the specific case and rely on the evidence, not the prerequisites, the presupposes. Those who worry that employers who would be compelled to hire dangerous pedophiles should look to HIV case law, where for years courts were highly conservative, erring on the side of finding direct threat even into the late 90s. The medical authorities were in agreement that people with HIV who work safely in, for example, like food services, removing pedophilia exclusion would not undermine the criminal justice or its role in responding to child abuse. It would not make it easier, for example, for someone accused of child molestation to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. Well, that's pretty weird, but yeah, nevertheless, I didn't think anybody could do that. But it's well written in that manner that you can't do that. I couldn't imagine. I mean, they're sick. There's nothing about that. But anyway, like I said, I wasn't going to comment too much about that, and I don't even want to do that. So I'm going to stay off of that. A pedophile should be held responsible for his conduct, but not for underlying attraction. Urging for the rights of scorned and misunderstood groups is never popular, particularly when they are associated with the real harm. But the fact that pedophilia is so despised is precisely why why our responses to it, our criminal justice and mental health, have been so inconsistent and counterproductive. Acknowledging that the pedophiles have a mental disorder and removing the obstacles to their own coming forward and seeking help is not only the right thing to do, but it would also advance the efforts of protecting children from harm. Well, see, the whole part of the article, which I just read here, the best part I've read was actually the last part, which seemed to make the most sense and resonates with me the most, and falls back to what I've talked about many times. Okay, well, we have this problem in society, so what are we going to do? Well, how can we deal with this? Please, please think about this. I really hope I haven't set somebody off or I've upset somebody, but this topic needs to be discussed. And this is all part of our awareness. It needs to be discussed. I know it certainly does here in Canada, because I know our laws are very lax in comparison to what they have in some of the states in the U.S. and I guess overall. Actually, that's the reason why I haven't decided to come forward and charge the people that have done that to me, and I won't go forward with it. I want to, but why would I go ahead and run the risk of being re-victimized again, for one thing, and if I do get a conviction, what, the guy is going to get maybe 3 years, 5 years, and then he'll will he be listed as a dangerous offender? You know, these questions are, as far as I'm concerned, are very valid. Like, I've been living with this for over 40 years, so to me, there's no justice in what I'm talking about. So if I go ahead and I decide to lay criminal charges against my abuser, and he gets 5 years, well, it doesn't really account for my 40-plus years of having to live in my own, well, crazy world that I've had to live in. And I'm putting it mildly. There's no way to describe, like, how can that individual ever understand what that that other person has gone through all their life just to survive. So this is why I say to you, and I would really appreciate any comments in regards to what I've talked about here. Now, like I said, I was making reference quite clear. What I read to you was from the U.S. This is their laws. I know right from the beginning when I said go, when I was doing this, that I would stick to basically to Canada, but it's really kind of hard to do that because I need to, rather, I found it necessary to make a reference so that we can understand how there's obviously differences in other countries, and this is what I'm talking about, like within the U.S. And I think what I'm going to do in the future is I'm going to dig a little bit deeper, and I really would like to know what they do in the U.K., because especially with all the controversy going on over there right now, I wouldn't want to be, I'd like to be a fly in the House of Lords over there right now, knowing all the stuff that's going on with all the controversial. And again, like I said, I'm not going to get too much into that, but my point being is, I will dig into it, and I'm going to dig into their laws a little bit deeper, and I know I'm going to dig into ours a little bit deeper, but as I've stated already, our laws, in my personal opinion, are way too lax as far as what to do with these people after they've offended. And I should throw this out too as well. It's also a great topic for discussion as well. Okay, after they've been incarcerated here, and they've gone through the program, so what happens when they get out of jail? They go to the halfway house. I know in the article I just read to you, or rather read to you, that it states that they do have programs for offenders when they get out of jail. But I'm not 100% clear on this, but from what I understand here, that there's very few or none as far as programs for offenders when they come out of jail here. I know they have programs if you've been abusive or like if you've committed a violent crime or something like that, but they've got nothing for pedophilia, not that I'm aware of anyway. And if they do, I haven't heard about it. And from the people I know that work with this stuff, I haven't heard anything of the sort either. I know there needs to be a program developed in regards to that, because to me it would be a lot easier on society if we could deal with them when they get out of jail and not have to worry about them after, because there has to be some form of treatment. And they just don't give it to them. And maybe they don't know what to do with them. I have no idea, but I'm just throwing these ideas at you. And you can email me and let me know your thoughts on this topic. And like I said, right from the beginning, when I started talking about this, most of us as survivors or victims or victim survivors, we would much prefer that our offenders be, let's put it this way, euthanized. And granted, that solves the problem, but that doesn't get rid of the problem that we've been left with. So that's why I throw it out at you. Well, what do we do? What do we do with these people? How do we treat them? How do we make them fit for society, so that we can incorporate them back into society where we don't have to worry about them trying to get at our children or do anything against humanity, basically. But my question to you is, well, what do you do with these people? I mean, sure, we can do things like chemical castration. We can list them as dangerous offenders, make them wear GPS bracelets for the rest of their lives. But we still have this problem. While we're still having to maintain, we still have to watch them. But where is the justice for the survivor in this? If the person has been incarcerated and he's done his time now, and he has a psychological problem like pedophilia, how do you deal with that? See, this is a great topic for discussion and controversial too, I may add. That's why I feel that it should be brought up. Because if the public was to address this a little bit more to our politicians, then maybe something might change. Maybe Corrections Canada will do a better study on it. May find funds on on how to deal with them other than the ways I've described, such as like chemical castration, for example, fear of the urge. And then when they finally release them, they have to wear bracelets. They have to be constantly monitored. That is a huge, huge burden on the taxpayer. You know, and not only that, but it's also psychologically very difficult for society to deal with that, especially for the survivors of the people that they've done. So if you release them back into society and they've had no treatment, well, how else would society feel knowing that you're going to let a pedophile out and he could very potentially reoffend and he's had virtually, or he's had absolutely no treatment whatsoever? So that would make everybody feel very much unease. And I feel that this subject has room for much more discussion and really, really should finally once and for all be dealt with in a what I would call a professional manner, because I honestly believe they've got all these brilliant people that are running the country and yet they can't seem to come together. They can build a bomb, but they can't figure this out. It's beyond me. I don't know. And I'm not going to put too much more thought into that as I just threw in front of you. But nevertheless, I've given you something to think about. And I would appreciate your comments at personaltransformation@thegatehouse.org. Whether it be negative or positive, you may even hate me after what I've just talked about. But the point being is it's right here in front of our faces all the time. And it cannot be ignored. It must be addressed. And so that's why I say to you, think about this. Talk to your MP. We got a federal election coming up next year, so that's something to think about. Definitely think about. You know, like look at guys like Paul Bernardo. You know, Colonel Ollie. I mean, I'm just giving you two examples. Like, I mean, there's other names I can. Gordon Stuckless. There's another name there. You know, like from Maple Leaf Gardens. Like, how can somebody like that get away with all that? And basically, he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. Well, he'll never get out of jail. Not Gordon Suckless, but guys like say Paul Bernardo, he'll never get out. And which is a good thing because he's definitely dangerous to society. But Gordon Suckless, like I talk about, if he's abused, I don't know, maybe I don't even know the count now. It's well, put it this way, it's a staggering amount of number. It's uncomprehendable how anybody can even. I can't believe he got away with it as long as he did, you know. But I do believe why he got away with it, because no one was strong enough to come forward, and I totally, totally get that. Totally, totally get that. But something like that should not be allowed out. And let me quite clear: this is only my opinion. That's all. This is my opinion. It's not the Gatehouse's opinion. It's just my opinion, and I'm not. It's not right or wrong. It's just my opinion. And what I'm trying to get across is that this situation, this problem which we have in society, needs to be dealt with on a lot more in-depth level than what it has been in years gone by. I do truly believe that if we bring the right people together, they can come up with something, some kind of therapy to treat these people. You know, I've made reference to... I made it quite clear too. This is a really big myth. Just because you've been abused doesn't mean that you're an offender yourself. Let me be quite clear that less than 1% of people who have been abused reoffend. So that's a pretty small percentage if you think about it. Very, very small percentage. And there's other reasons too why they would do such a thing. Obviously psychological. But nevertheless, the problem is still there. So I've given you a whole bunch of things to think about tonight. I've talked about addictions. All the different forms of addictions. And then I basically bounce right into this pedophilia thing. No wonder we resort to addictions after we've been through what we've been through. But I felt, nevertheless, this stuff needs to be discussed. It can't be swept under the carpet anymore. And I'm here to voice it, to exercise my right to voice it and let you know that you're not the only one out there, and I will fight to the end to hopefully change some things. And maybe I will, maybe I won't. I don't know. I'm just going to keep fighting until something changes, unless I want, so that there's better awareness of this problem. Again, I'm going to make a couple announcements before I turn tonight off. Again, I apologize for not having John Swales here. I did list it as a possibility that I might be interviewing him. But like I say, I've made the arrangements. I'm going to interview him right here from the house tomorrow night. So I'm really looking forward to that. We could have, when I was talking to him earlier tonight, we could have had a conversation for about a half hour. But I really felt that a half hour conversation would not cover the length of what he's doing. Would not be fair to him, and he was a bit under the gun himself for what he was doing tonight. So, again, like I say, I got a couple announcements, and October 25th, Saturday, we're having a bowling fundraiser, which will be at 2561 Stanfield Road, Mississauga, Ontario. It'll be from 3 to 5 p.m. You can call the gatehouse for availability at 416-856-5900, extension 225, or just ask for, if you get somebody on the phone, just ask for Paul or Maria, or actually you can even ask for Stephanie, and she's actually the one looking after her. You can email her at stephanie@thegatehouse.org. Just giving you some options here. So $20 per person, and the money raised will be coming back to the gatehouse. And then on Friday, November the 14th, 8 p.m. to 1 p.m. at the Mr. Mike and Maple Leaf Lounge presents Oakland Stroke. They're basically a 10-piece soul funk band with a 5-piece horn section and a bunch of other great musicians from Toronto. Some of these musicians have played in the Toronto Jazz Festival, Beaches Festival, New Market, Southside Shuffle, Mississauga. So a lot of these musicians are local, but they're great musicians. And money raised will be coming back to the gatehouse. So again, I say to you, thank you for your time. I appreciate any response, whether it be good or bad. You can email the house at www.thegatehouse.org or myself at personaltransformation@thegatehouse.org. And like I say, good or bad, I'll take it. You can call at 416-255-5900. And we are located at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard West in Toronto, our old Etobicoke. And have a great night. Have a great week. And I look forward to being on here again next Thursday. And most importantly, take care of yourselves. And if you are having a problem, call somebody, talk to somebody. But have a great weekend. Thank you for your time, and I'll talk to you again. Good night for now.